America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
With me on the line on America Trends, of course, is my friend and colleague and partner in this effort, John Krawczyk. And John, this is a really important podcast that we are about to share with our listeners today. I think it's unfortunate, but it's real, that Marjory Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where we had that tragic shooting a few years back, is back in the news because of the congresswoman from Georgia and her pursuit of David Hogg, who's become a real activist as it relates to gun safety, a survivor of what happened at Parkland. So it's a very unfortunate set of circumstances that to bring us here today, because I'm not certain that Jeff Foster, who is the advanced placement government teacher at the high school, would have been the person encouraging a lot of these young people to become the activists that they now are, of course, if it were not for this tragedy.
Activism is good. I've seen a lot of that in the news lately, and I think it's good. As long as the activism doesn't turn into any type of violence toward people, I think having our future involved is a wonderful thing, and I think that we need more of it.
Well, these young people, John, as you recall, they held rallies subsequent to this. They encouraged legislation at the state level in Florida. They, of course, were meeting with congressional folks because that's where this Marjory Greene was stalking David Hogg. And she was the one telling him that she is packing. And David Hogg and these young people have done nothing but to prove themselves to be really just a great adherents to a cause that involved them so personally with the loss of their friends and colleagues and other teachers. So it's a remarkable story. It really is. And I've got to tell you, John, very honestly, that when a fine publicist brought this topic to me, at first, I didn't quite see how we could make this as relevant as we have for our adult listening audience, because the book that was written by Jeff Foster and encouraged by Scholastic is really meant for young people 8 to 14 years old. And we will talk about that book. It's an important book called For Which We Stand, How Our Government Works and Why It Matters. Now, we do talk to Jeff Foster about the importance of understanding the system if you're really going to be able to affect it for change. But then we talk about the issues related to the Parkland shooting and the young people that he inspired.
I think it's good that they're standing up and you know, they live that down there at Douglas High School. So it's good that they're in the public, and I think anybody who stalks them and is out to get them, you know, there's a fine line between having a different opinion and stalking somebody and trying to, you know, hurt them or something. So,
you know, tragedy built upon tragedy. By the way, John, my long-lasting recollection of government classes was how a bill becomes a law. I'll never forget that one sheet that we used to get when we were young people telling us that this is how the system works. And I find it remarkable today how few people really do understand the system. In many ways, the Trump administration impeachment has reminded us of some of the practices of government. But I've got to tell you, recently, when I heard a senator, now this isn't a state senator, John, this is a federal senator just elected, Tommy Tuberville from Alabama. And he was saying, we've got to really explain to people about the three branches of government. You know, the president, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. And I'm saying, he doesn't even know what the three branches of the government are, and he now is a U.S. senator. By the way, the third branch, folks, is the judiciary, and the House and the Senate are the legislative branch in combination. But isn't that amazing how little about civics people know?
Well, it's sad. It's sad, and I bet you if we went on the street and we asked that question, I bet you we would, unfortunately, not get the right answers. So I think it's a sad state of affairs for our country, and but I also think it's a sad state of affairs that Congress really isn't doing its job anymore. And, you know, we got a lot of problems in government, a lot. But that's another podcast.
Well, that's another podcast, and we do that one regularly, as you know, John. But this one is about how a new generation of young people can step up, step forward, and make a difference. And I think that's a really important message today. And you're going to hear it from Jeff Foster, and you're going to learn firsthand his role in inspiring these young people on America Trends. With me on America Trends is Jeff Foster, and he has written a book called For Which We Stand, How Our Government Works and Why It Matters. And it's geared to children 8 to 14. But to understand why he wrote it, you'd have to understand what his occupation is. And he is the advanced placement government teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Now, that is a name that many of us conjure up some terrible memories going back a couple of years, and we'll get back to that in a moment because it's certainly part of the story. But Jeff, I do want to ask you, a lot of people bemoan the state of education, particularly how civics and government are not given the emphasis that they deserve. Do you agree with that?
100%. I mean, it's incredible as I've gone around and talked to different people, whether it was during the writing of the book or even the promoting of the book, and how many people I've spoken to never said they said they didn't have civics education in middle school or high school, which is incredible to me. I didn't realize it was that, you know, I knew it was lacking in America. I didn't know it was lacking that much in America, where you're going to go through an entire 13 years of school and never get civics education. And as I've, you know, continued to hear these stories from person after person, I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any stretch, but I wonder if that's intentional by the government just to have uninformed citizens so they can do whatever they can do whatever they want to do. And in the interim, we just walk around and say, it is what it is, and we move on with our day. So, I mean, I hope that's not the case, but it's alarming. I really wish that people, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I definitely did write the book for a younger audience, give them something that's engaging, something that's, you know, pretty to look at, something that has fun facts in it, something that has infographs and stuff that's going to keep kids' attention. At the same time, let them understand, you know, not only how the government works, but how they can make the government work for them as they move through this, you know, their next 30, 40, 50 years of their lives.
What's most scary is you said they might walk around saying it is what it is. The last person I heard say that was the president of the United States about the pandemic. Well,
that's true.
Let's move along. How difficult is it to teach a topic upon which Americans are so deeply divided, or a true rummaging around in our historical closet can upset a lot of people deeply because they may have these strongly held beliefs, but when you study it, they may be mistaken.
Yeah, it's a delicate balancing act for sure. I mean, I teach advanced placement kids, so these are really sharp 17 and 18-year-old kids with some definite opinions at their age, a lot more definite opinions than I had when I was their age. And we talk about, you know, everything that's going on in the country, and we talk about issues that definitely have two very distinct sides to them. And it becomes difficult sometimes, but, you know, all you can do as a civics educator, or all I can do as a civics educator, is try to just present them with what's going on, what are the two sides of it, and then try to basically argue both sides. When we do Socratic discussions where we're sitting around talking about, say, 2 years ago, we were talking about Black Lives Matter, or maybe when my first year, 20 years ago, we were talking about like abortion rights, when it was still, you know, I wouldn't say fresh, but it was, you know, it wasn't that far, 50 years removed from Roe. You know, the kids have very strong opinions, and you have to, you know, just set clear rules in the classroom and say, guys, just because, you know, little Jeff feels that way and you don't, doesn't make him a bad person, you know, and And, you know, I try to, you know, at least let them see that you can, and which is definitely different from America right now, that you can have an argument civilly with somebody, that you can have a debate civilly with someone. And if you don't agree with them, it doesn't make them evil incarnates, and you can actually try to, you know, compromise on something, or at least agree to disagree. And that's something that's definitely lacking in our government right now, for sure.
I'm wondering if you say to them, please understand that we only have a two-party system, and it doesn't
right.
really work like it does in a parliamentary system when you've got all kinds of fractions in terms of parties.
Yep.
You have to compromise to get anything done because you're two big tent parties.
To even piggyback on that, I mean, really, I try to preach, you know, not that a third party is going to sweep in this week and win, but, you know, we shouldn't be just beholden to those two parties. And we do have a two-party system, and it's sort of ingrained since the 1860s now, and the system is set up that way, and the only people that can change that system are the two parties themselves, and obviously, why would they change the system? But I think it's incumbent upon us not to just say, all right, this is the lesser of two evils, I'll vote Democrat this year, or this is the lesser of two evils, I'll vote Republican this year. I think maybe it's time for us to say, you know, enough of this, and let's start over and try to create a system where you're right, where it is like a multi-party parliamentary system, where you do have three or four or five parties working, because then different groups could work together, and we can have some new creative ideas in government, as opposed to the same old tired ideas just being regurgitated in incremental politics year after year after year. So you actually touched on something that I'm real passionate about the fact that...
Well, there are a lot of reforms that we could look at, like ranked
yes.
choice voting, which might
yep.
bring us to some point of moderation as people are looking to be either the first or second choice and maybe in a runoff. There are so many
mm-hmm.
things. Do you talk about those things with your students?
I do. We actually have that. We have that on one of our initiatives, ballot initiatives this year, is to allow that ranked voting during the primary season, to where hypothetically you could end up having two Democrats run against each other for a Senate seat or for a House seat, as opposed to the Democrat and Republican. I don't think it's going to pass in Florida. It really hasn't gotten that much run on the ads either so far. But yeah, there's multiple ways. I think the biggest deterrent for those third parties or any chance of having any other party having any option to win is just the fact our attitudes. You know, most people just believe that, you know, I could vote for, again, say I was running for office under the American Party. Jeff Foster seems like a good guy, but there's no chance he could win, so why should I waste my vote? And that's this attitude that pervades in America, and that's the biggest issue for any of these candidates that are trying to win third party. Because, again, whether you're Ralph Nader, whether you're Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, who all got 3%, 4%, 5%, or even go back to Ross Perot, you know, three decades ago, who got double digits, which was amazing. But again, they got no credit for it because, as you know, it's a winner-take-all system in America. And even though Perot garnered 10% of the vote, he didn't get any electoral votes. So it's basically like all he did was cost, you know, George Bush the election, or all Ralph Nader did was cost Al Gore the election, or whatever, however you want to try to spin it. And I don't agree with that either, because if Jeff Foster, the hypothetical third-party candidate, appeals to you, you shouldn't have to just blindly give your vote to Donald Trump or Joe Biden. You should be able to give it to Jeff Foster and feel good about voting for Jeff Foster. By the way, I'm not announcing that I'm running for office, I promise.
Well, you might, but we'll talk about it. But let me ask you this. You speak about your love of our system, and here we're talking about some of its challenges
yes,
and
right.
perhaps its problems, particularly as the two parties have become more polarized. We used to have big tent parties where you
mm-hmm.
could have liberals
sure.
in the Republican Party and conservatives, many from the South, in the Democratic Party. And basically, we don't see a lot of that any longer. So our choices are even more stark. But how do
mm-hmm.
you address, for example, because I would imagine with all the smart kids that you have in your class, that they're looking at some of the things that we have put in place that you describe in your book. They look at the Electoral College, they look at the U.S. Senate, they look at gerrymandering by state legislatures,
mm-hmm.
and it really is all seemingly there to thwart the will of the people. These
yes.
are anti-majoritarian elements to our republic. How do you describe that to them?
I mean, it's all about having power and keeping power, and that's really where we're at. I mean, you can't do anything in this country without the position. I mean, going back to what we were just talking about third parties, like even though the Reform or the Green Party has some decent ideas, if they don't get representation in Congress, they can't push those ideas out there. So you're right, whether it was the Electoral College ensuring that the average person didn't pick a terrible president, or whether it was the Senate being originally elected by the state legislatures, and really going back to the the impetus to this question about the Big Ten parties as well. I think a big issue that exists in America right now is you do get vilified if you are a liberal Republican or you are a conservative Democrat, like a Joe Manchin, let's say, and you go out and you do something with the other party. Joe Manchin goes out and agrees with Donald Trump on something. Well, he might wake up the next day and the Democratic Party might have four people running against him in the primary. I mean, it's like because of the coverage and because of this 24/7 news cycle that just, again, vilifies anybody that, God forbid, a Republican supported Obama or, God forbid, a Democrat supports Trump. It's like automatic, like, all right, let's cancel that person if I can use the current vernacular. And we'll move on to the next Democrat because they realize that, you know, that state probably based on gerrymandering is already, you know, set up in their district to allow a Republican to win. So if this Republican isn't toeing the line, let's just put another Republican in place of him. Or same thing with Democrats. And it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, I'm friendly with a few congressmen and senators that I've been fortunate enough to meet after our terrible tragedy at our school. And, you know, we talk all the time, and I feel like they're decent people as human beings. But when it comes time to the political side of it, they dig right in and they toe the party line because they realize that, frankly, their job could be in danger if they don't. And that's a dangerous thing that we're living right now, for sure.
Does it surprise you how much they seem to sacrifice common sense and principle, as you might see it, for the sake of retention of power?
It's all about having the power. They realize that their power is only exists if they're part of that system. So, I mean, I'm sure they could get good jobs with you know, the connections they've made. But it gets to you, and you can see the way they act. I mean, whether it's Pelosi or Trump, or I'll mention the big people that, or Mitch McConnell, they just thumb their nose at anybody that disagrees with them, and that person is wrong, and they don't care. And the funny thing is their party, you know, they become heroic to their party when they act that way. The more petulant you become, the more, like, you know, impressed you are within your own party, and the more that people rally around you, and that is a I don't want to say a dangerous, but it's a bad look for our system. But that's sort of, you know, where we're at in 2020.
Well, this is really important for you to get all this on the table, because when you look at your book, For Which We Stand, in many ways it is a really beautifully illustrated book, and there's lots in it that I think is going to help a young person to understand the way our system is meant to work, not necessarily how our system does work.
Right.
So when I was in school, I used to have that little pamphlet, How a Bill Becomes a Law. Mm-hmm. And that was before I majored in poli-sci in college. And my notion of that never really got cluttered up with lobbyists and dark money and procedural tricks and polarization. Those were things that really somehow we kind of left out of the handbook, if you will.
So I miss the Schoolhouse Rocks. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I'm just wondering, you know, when you look at it, you've seen it now, not only as a teacher telling about how we think it should work, but how it really does. How different is the reality from the abstract?
It's extremely different. I mean, you think, again, that, you know, laws are going to be introduced by congressmen that come from the people, and they're going to debate it, and they're going to go out, and they're going to, you know, sort of do informal polls of their constituents, and they're going to vote that way. And again, the word compromise, which unfortunately doesn't exist in America right now, and they're going to come to this awesome bill that's going to benefit the most people. That's what James Madison said when he wrote Federalist Number 10, that our system itself is going to be set up to where all the ideas are going to be put on the table because we're a democracy, and the best idea is going to win, the benefits the most people. And that's ultimately what we're supposed to be, but devolved into this, whichever interest group has the most money, the most organization, and the most members, because the people aren't paying attention. We're busy keeping up with the Kardashians and not keeping up with the House and the Senate, that's the policies that we made to benefit those interest groups. So instead of a participatory or majoritarian democracy like we're supposed to have, we have a pluralist society where very few people are making the decisions for the majority. And that's, again, I'm feeling like we're tearing down our government here. The government system is a great system. It's just not being executed properly right now, I think.
Well, did we see that power to the established class of political types, or did they take it from us? And how
I think
do we
it's
get
a com-
it back?
I think it's a combination of both, and the way we got to get it back is we just have to, and it's a difficult task because I got it. We're all living in some trying times right now, and we're trying to pay our bills, and we're trying to keep our jobs, and we're trying to keep our families safe. And on top of that, I'm here telling you, like, by the way, you got to pay attention to what's going on, you know, in your state capital, what's going on in your city government, what's going on at the national level. It's a lot, but I can counter that by saying there's a lot of information out there today, and it's not that difficult just to at least be well enough versed to know when you're supposed to vote, you know, how you can vote, who supports what, and ultimately, you know, if something comes up that directly impacts you, you should probably get involved. You don't have to give money to anything. You don't have to necessarily join an interest group. You can absolutely join some kind of advocacy group, or you can just go out there to put your pen to paper and, you know, and try to make substantial differences to any type of legislation at any level of government in this country. It's again, I don't mean to keep repeating it, but it's incumbent on us to do that. And frankly, the politicians and the parties and the system at large is saying, it's okay. We've got this. just stay over there in the corner.
We'll be a bystander, but there are
right.
No,
we'll let you know when it's time to vote us back
longer.
In, basically.
And yep. And that became so apparent to you and to your students when, of course, this tragedy befell your high school, Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, back in 2018. Don't shoot kids. That was a simple message. Now, I want to talk about it in the context of 2020. We're in the midst of all of that. But let me ask you, what was it that happened the day after as it relates to these kids in your class who luckily survived this rampage? Yeah. Tell us what happened. Give us the story and what your role was in it.
I mean, essentially, it happened on, I believe, a Wednesday or Thursday. I think it was a Thursday, actually, Valentine's Day. And within 24 hours, you know, a group of kids, the majority of my students that year, and there's others that I've had since that were only juniors or sophomores at the time, they organized at one of the kids' houses and said, you know, basically enough is enough. We need to figure out how this works. And, you know, they have obviously a good upbringing, good parents, and they learned, you know, how they could affect the system. They weren't afraid of anything. A lot of them were drama kids. A lot of them were kids that did the local newscasts at our school, MSC News, which is a big program as well. So it was a combination of sort of having the right kids along with, you know, three or four or five, I don't want to say five teachers, but a handful of teachers that had taught them the proper ways to write, to speak, and how to use the government for them. And they organized pretty organically with some aid from us, you know, occasional phone call here or there. And then basically they just said, hey, can you, you know, come along with us to Tallahassee? You know, we're probably going to need you. Can you come along with us to Washington, D.C.? And I helped on the organization side of it in terms of making sure that we got all of our – anybody that from Parkland that wanted to go to either place to try to impact, you know, the policies there, I said, let's make sure it happens. We had a lot of donations from around the country to help us out. And essentially in 3 days we were in Tallahassee talking to lawmakers, and 1 month and 10 days after the incident at our school, we were in Washington, D.C. marching, you know, with over 1 million people participating around the country, and kids that were sitting in my class, you know, worrying about who they were going to go to prom with, were suddenly speaking to 1 million people with the poise of a seasoned politician. And you know, and collectively, the ability to use social media obviously helps a lot. We were able to organize very quickly a lot of people, and to this day, and then later that summer, get young people to go out and vote. They went on a voting tour that summer, and they're still out there actively right now. I mean, the majority of the kids.
Well, I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But when we think about MSD Strong, Delaney Tarr, Emma Gonzalez, David Hogg in particular, they've become household names, challenging adult authority early on. What does that portend for them and youth? Because we're seeing that a lot of young people seem much more motivated today, and I'm not certain how much this issue has motivated them. Many issues, I think climate change, there are a number. What do you think animates this generation?
Just the fact that, you know, for those kids in particular, they literally saw their classmates and their teachers and their coaches die in front of them. And it struck them as incredulous that they couldn't do anything about it and that nobody really cared. And us, I can speak, you know, for myself and for them on this. We met people from Columbine. We met people from Sandy Hook. And just to see the, you know, the just the angst in their being of that, you know, Columbine has been over 20 years for Sandy Hook at the time. It was, I think, 5 years. And to see that they were trying to do what we were doing with absolutely little or zero success was so frustrating. And these kids took it upon themselves to say, we're not going to relent. We're not going to allow this to stop. And as you said, I mean, again, there's no question that social media has a major impact on it as well, because they can get their words out there more. And these kids were, for lack of a better word, they were characters. They were smart kids. They were, you know, they all sort of had a different look about them, almost, you know, which is kind of weird, Alex Jones-esque, almost like they were cast for the role, but they were, you know. One, we had a girl with a shaved head. We had a newscaster who wore glasses. We had the tall, skinny kid with the crazy hair that was passionate, that loved to curse every 3 seconds. And and these kids, you know, they captivated not only the youth, but a lot of, I'm friends with them as well. Still talk to them all the time and still, you know, follow them on Twitter and back and forth. And you can see how many, you know, adults just hang on their every word. Now, do I agree with everything they've done, everything they've said, everything, every way they've acted? I don't, but they're young. So some of that stuff's excusable, but sometimes I do, not that I apologize for anything they've done. I think they've done a wonderful job, but sometimes I will get phone calls and say, hey, don't you think, you know, person A has gone a little too far on this? And I'm like, maybe, but still, you know, you got to give them a little bit of a pass. And ultimately, they're going to be held responsible for what they say and what they do. Because I know, like, David wants to run for office in a few years, and he's 20.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering how many of them now, really, as a result of this, are going to be politicians. And I've loved your definition, because I've asked this of a number of my guests. What is a politician, now that you have seen them really in the flesh, up close, and you've had to contest some of their objections. What is a politician in your mind?
A politician is someone that is chosen by the people. I'm trying to be a book definition and at the same time, you know, be pragmatic about it. Someone who's chosen by the people to enact laws on our behalf, to represent us and to really do our bidding at the local, federal, or state level. Now, that being said, does that always happen? It doesn't, because of our lack of participation. So, I mean, the standard definition is it's someone that's elected to office to represent a group of people. Again, whether it's
a district.
Well,
I guess what I'm trying to get at is what skills do they really need? In other words, some are fast talkers. Some are just attractive and have a likability factor. But what skills do they need? What really separates a good politician, aside from telling us the truth, perhaps, being straightforward with us, and somebody who does their constituent work? But what is it that you think really defines, because you've seen them all now, and you've seen them in both parties?
It's a difficult question, because there's the variance of our last two presidents is so dramatic, and I think they're both successful politicians, right? I mean, one sort of ran on hope, and the other one sort of ran on fear. Not sort of, they both ran on hope, one ran on fear, and they both are very successful. So, I mean, it's amazing to me when I see politicians, you know, in the flesh, you know, how different they all are on a personal level, and how they're all able to connect with people. So I guess the number one, and you're right, I mean, it helps to be attractive. It helps to obviously be an eloquent speaker. It helps to be someone that has sympathy or empathy. But again, I don't want to pick on the current occupant of the White House, but I don't think he's very empathetic, and he seems to be a successful politician to at least half the country. So it's just your, I guess, first and foremost, it's to be able to be engaging and to be able to have, you know, at least enough of awareness to realize where you are and be able to really be a chameleon, because you're talking to a lot of different people and a lot of different groups and a lot of times people that absolutely you disagree with 100%, but you can't blatantly, unless you're living in one of those districts that's so gerrymandered or so slanted towards your party, you gotta, you know, obviously listen and smile, but ultimately they would be judged on their actions, but unless things change pretty dramatically, most of these guys and girls, as you know, being a political science major, are rubber stamped back into office every 2 years or every 6 years. There's over 90% incumbency rate even though the congressional approval rating is lower than 20%.
Yeah, it's an amazing dichotomy.
Yeah.
Jeff Foster is with us. He's written the book, For Which We Stand, How Our Government Works and Why It Matters. And, of course, it matters life and death as a government teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. The Second Amendment, obviously, is a big part of the conversation that you have had undoubtedly before, but more particularly after what befell your school. How has your teaching of the Second Amendment changed?
I know a lot more about it now, obviously, in terms of the way it's broken down. I can almost go back to how we sort of talked about it when we were sort of planning, you know, our it's going to be a weird word to use, our stalls in the media in terms of trying to get people to change their minds about guns and specifically weapons of war. I actually was just on a committee to try to ban assault weapons in the state of Florida, try to get it on the as a ballot initiative this year, and we unfortunately came up short in the Florida Supreme Court, but we're going to try again in 2 years. I, again, as I talked before, I mean, I've got kids that are there. I've got kids that are very still pro Second Amendment. I have a lot of hunters in my class, and I have a lot of kids that are obviously very anti Second Amendment, especially the last 3 years after the shooting. And to be able to deal with that in open discussion is not easy. But ultimately, you know, you just when I talk to either side of that, you know, you just basically say that the militia didn't, you know, this right to bear arms wasn't created to ensure that every single person can have, you know, a bazooka and walk down the street. And that's sort of what we've become. And that's, you know, in terms of people that are hardcore pro Second Amendment, we'll say. But on the other side, you know, I've been with my kids, my Douglas kids in my community, where on one hand, they'll tell people to their face, like, listen, we're not trying to take your guns. You know, we just want to have common sense gun legislation. And then 2 days later, they're protesting outside Walmart because Walmart's selling guns.
Did the young people from your high school who really did get the attention of the American public, and many felt at the time, and this isn't that long ago, they really were going to be the difference makers. I live in Connecticut. And Sandy Hook certainly had an impact on state gun laws, but not on federal gun laws. We know that. And yet, along came COVID-19. And for the moment, in a twist of fate, it quelled any future rampages. But, of course, it gave us other problems to deal with. And yet we learned that timing is so important, because I've got to tell you, in the course of the 2020 campaign, I've heard so little about gun safety, and yet without the pandemic, it would have been such an important issue, I do think. So the importance of timing as it relates to this issue and others, put that in some context as somebody who's been on the front lines of activism about this issue.
Yeah, you need to strike while it's in the news. I mean, you know, again, I couldn't, myself and most certainly the kids, I mean, we had carte blanche to talk to whoever we wanted to talk to, go wherever we wanted to go, get invited to every. We were invited to anything and everything in Washington and Tallahassee, you know, and people wanted us there because we were the faces of, you know, this movement to try to curb gun control and that access. Although we wish we didn't have it, because we wish that, you know, obviously the event didn't happen at our school, we took full advantage of in trying to, you know, get our word out there. But you're right, as time changes, and it's a pretty quick moving clock, you're kind of brought to the back of the line. And I mean, I can speak to even the school, like when, you know, that first 6 months to a year, people were calling our school on a daily basis just saying, what do you need? What do you need? What do you need? You know, whether it's food for the staff, whether it's security, whether it's, you know, make it look prettier, et cetera. And then you go a year down the line and you make a phone call to, you know, do anything. And it's like, oh, who are you guys? You know, oh, great. That was a year ago. We move on to the next thing. So yeah, the timing is critical, and you know, and that's really what, you know, the NRA, for instance, who obviously is on a different side of the gun argument than my kids. That's what they count on. They count on people being upset initially, no matter what the issue is, and allowing them to sort of get out there and get their word out, and then they just kind of wait it out, and they realize that they have this trump card, for lack of a better word, to be able to have, you know, direct access to these candidates, and eventually they're going to wait you out. And when it comes time to to craft legislation against what they believe in, generally the big interest groups end up winning. So they'll put out the proper stuff. The NRA say, we feel bad, it's terrible, we wish this never happened, and they'll just kind of be silent. But then when it's time for them to put their full might behind defeating a bill or an uprising of the citizens, ultimately they're still giving more money to the candidates, and ultimately they still have their, you know, are controlling one of the two parties, whether you're talking about gun policy or environmental policy, you know, on either side of the aisle. That's sort of the way it works.
Well, the young people who were at your high school at the time, who become public figures in many ways, how do they look upon their experience? Is it that they're going to be more activist in the future? Are they more cynical now because of what they've seen? And do they think they have affected anything materially and long-term in our system, in our culture?
I think it depends on who you speak to directly on that for which job. But I think overall, most of them are still very optimistic that they're making a difference. They're still out there on the front lines trying to make a difference. As I mentioned, a lot of them are getting into politics, whether it's, you know, on the direct side of trying to get elected, or just, you know, behind the scenes, groups, organization, et cetera. Others have become somewhat cynical, which is, you know, not a great way to be at 19, 20 years old, obviously, but it's also understandable. But ultimately, I think the majority of them will still remain active. There's no question that they're really engaged in this election. And, you know, the one thing that I saw in 2018, which was obviously the same year of the event, in that November election, you know, we were obviously very engaged in getting people out to vote, and we had a big election party at one of the local restaurants, and we all met there, and you know, there was coverage from the press, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And to watch these kids, because we lost, when I say we, I'm just talking about the movement, whether or not individually you voted for, but overall, the majority of the kids in that group were rooting for a specific candidate for governor and a specific candidate for senator in the state of Florida that year. And to watch the how despondent they were as the vote finally came in, and both the candidates they supported lost, you know, and watch the tears. And I said, guys, it's that's okay. You did some amazing things. You're not going to win every battle. It doesn't mean you quit, though. And then they understood that, and they haven't quit. But to see it that soon afterwards and not get the results you were looking for, you can understand why someone would become cynical or become maybe, you know, like, all right, I tried, I'm out of here now. But the credit to them, most of them, you know, whether it's something as basic as just putting out stuff on social media to keep people engaged, or whether it's someone who's out there, you know, like David, who 24/7 is beating his drum, you know, they're still battling for what they believe is right. And ultimately, and I'll quote young David Hogg here, he always says the young people will win. And I mean, by continuing to say it, by continuing to push it, he's hoping that he can take this new generation of voters or activists or influencers and galvanize them to change the way the system works and decide what's, you know, what America is going to deem important for the next 30 or 40 years, I think.
I know that Sandy Hook did result in a lot of reforms here in the state of Connecticut, but as we know, guns travel across state lines.
Yes.
Did you get much done in Tallahassee in Florida?
Not.
Were there many pieces of legislation that did get passed?
There was very little legislation, and then the stuff that was passed was later struck down by the governor and the legislature. So, yeah, it wasn't completely empty, but very, very little meaningful legislation was what was passed, and that's why we were trying as a group collectively, through with the help of a couple of our congressmen and some other important people in the state, to try to get this at least at minimum banning assault weapons again in the state of Florida. But as I mentioned before, we were unsuccessful in getting it on the ballot this time. You know, we were right at the end of the session when we went up there that year, and they did pass, again, minimal changes, but most of that has been, you know, basically eradicated in the last year and a half now.
You said that your favorite chapter in your book, again, which is called For Which We Stand, is probably the one on activism. Why is that? And what do you want to say today to anyone listening to this podcast about activism, given your experience with it?
You know, there's so many opportunities in this country to make a difference. Again, from the lowest level of government to the grandest stage, and there's no reason for us just to sit around and allow others to make decisions for us and not be involved, basically. I mean, whether it's, again, something as simple as just organizing a group of people to do something or marching or filing a petition. I mean, it could be something as, it could be anything. I mean, my youngest daughter is an environmental, you know, she loves the environment, and we use, you know, she influenced me and my wife. We were not big recyclers until the last couple of years. And I never realized, you know, like, why I didn't recycle. I guess it was just because I'm like, oh, why do I need to, you know, separate my garbage and everywhere else? And I was almost like, ah, I'm not going to do that. It sounds silly. And then when my little one was passionate about it, I'm like, my God, how hard is it for me to put a bottle, you know, in a different trash bin? And now we use metal reusable straws. So every person in their own little way can make a difference, no matter what you care about. And it's not difficult from the youngest kid to our oldest citizens. I mean, obviously the minimum you can do once you're 18 is to vote, but the maximum you can do, it's really endless. It's limitless what we can do as citizens. And I mean, you and I obviously got to get together and we got to figure out why these states are continuing to suppress civic education around the country. I would think, I'm really curious, and this is obviously going to be a little bit of an aberration in terms of when the turnout numbers finally come out from this election, which will be probably months down the line. You know, at some point, you know, we're going to see that if we all galvanize around an issue, around a candidate, around a party, maybe we can get stuff done. And if stuff gets done that the majority of us like, then we should put these people back in office and say, let's continue to do it. And if not, let's, instead of doing the norm, let's vote people out, or maybe even follow Ted Cruz's lead and say, let's get term limits in the House and the Senate. You know, I mean, I know it's not a popular opinion within there, but a couple guys like to say it because they know that it's never going to happen. So,
right. I saw Deborah Hickson on television, yeah. And I know she's running for office. Her husband, Chris, was gunned down. We should not forget that it wasn't only students, that the faculty were killed as well. She's running for Board of Education, and her son, Corey, and the viral moment that he had with Joe Biden. What has the impact been on your school, on your school community overall, would you say?
There's no question we're much more active as a community. Just 2 weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to be asked to moderate two debates, one for mayor of Parkland and one for the city commission spots of Parkland. And I'm even though I don't live in the community, I'm about 30 minutes north of Parkland. I grew up in that general vicinity. And to see, you know, when we're talking about people not paying attention and people allowing others to do stuff for them, that's not Parkland. I mean, Parkland is extremely active. I mean, it's sad that it took a catastrophic event like it took for kids, people to become active. But I mean, we are, what it did long term in the community is again, it activated us. It gets, there's not a citizen in Parkland that I've come across that doesn't know who's running for office, what they stand for. Obviously, the community is very close knit. Obviously, we rally around, you know, each other in terms of, you know, because we're certainly not close to being completely healed yet, you know, from the youngest kid to the teachers at the school. This is actually our final year with kids that were at the school in 2018. Our freshman class that year are now seniors. So there's a whole different set of, every year it's been like a different set of issues in terms of how we deal with the students. And you know, you can't not believe a kid when he says that he or she is struggling, you know, because they heard a sound or something triggered something in them. And it's a difficult thing to deal with when you're dealing with 15 to 18 year old kids. But the community at large, you know, rallied. Everybody really cares for each other. Again, back to those debates, they were very civil a couple of weeks ago. I'm not saying we're the civilest little town in America. It's far from that. But there's a lot more respect paid to each other because of the trauma that the community, you know, went through together.
If I was in your class and I was just kind of a struggling teenager, which I was many, many years ago.
Yes, sure.
And I said to you, well, you know, Mr. Foster, your book is great. And, you know, we're so glad that it has a primer for a lot of young people. But I really worry that my voice doesn't count And we see the weight of a political voice. In other words, certain people have a lot more weight than others. And we saw people taking to the streets in the recent period in America saying that their voices have never been weighted appropriately. And we heard Doc Rivers, the coach, who said it more beautifully than anyone I've ever heard. You know, we, the African-American community, let's say, in America, we love this country. It doesn't love us back. How do you respond to me as a meek freshman or sophomore coming into your class saying my political voice is not heard? It's a very subtle, very thin reed of a voice, and others have a lot of power.
Yeah, I mean, after you have to, you know, pragmatically say you probably acknowledge it at first and say you're probably right. Your age group doesn't have that much of an influence on politics, but that doesn't mean you can't if you're able to, you know, get involved and multiply your voice. I know Matt Deitch, who was one of my students, who was involved with the content creation for the March for Our Lives. He has a little part at the end of my book about organizing, and he quotes Martin Luther King Jr. from, I believe, when he was in jail in Birmingham, saying that, you know, instead of trying to organize a march of 10,000 people, try to get 50 of your friends to do something with you. You know, everybody can organize 10 people or 20 people or 50 people. So instead of going for this grandiose, well, I mean, we were fortunate enough to get, you know, a million people to show up at the march in Washington, D.C., 10 gun violence. But that doesn't mean if you can't get 30 people, you can't make a difference and you can't, you know, have you make your voice heard. But the key thing is, I think, is try not to be the lone person. You need to find groups that you agree with. You need to not necessarily organize, but seek out people that have similar beliefs as you. And then, again, be able to amplify your voice. I've had those conversations with a lot of those type kids, and there's no question when you have a David Hogg and an Emma Gonzalez and a Delaney Tarr and a Matt Dykes in your class, and they are even, you know, before or after, and you're having a discussion, those kids do tend to dominate those discussions because they're very passionate kids, and they do have a lot of knowledge. And so, you know, as an educator, it's my job to make sure that every one of these kids' voices are heard. If I do have a kid that's a little bit more of a wallflower, don't put them in a spot to where they're going to be embarrassed because they're afraid to speak up. But maybe take them aside at the end of the class. If they don't seek me out, maybe seek them out and ask them what they care about, what they're passionate about. And that's one of the jobs as a teacher, as an educator, as a human being, is to try to help others, you know, find their way and find their place and hopefully have as much influence or as little influence as they want to have. Because not everybody wants to be on that stage. But if they want to be, I am happy to nurture any of them and give them as much aid as I can to basically make them happier in their existence. Because, again, not to tie everything back to our incident, but we've had a lot of kids that are wondering, you know, maybe why they survived and their friend didn't, who was sitting next to them in class. So we've had a lot of those conversations with a lot of kids on a lot of different levels about their place in society, their place in the world, their place in our community.
Well, your book is published by Scholastic, and Scholastic has been associated with so many wonderful books for young people. This one, For Which We Stand, which is really focused on kids 8 to 14 and a better understanding of our government. I can't thank you enough, Jeff Foster, for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.